Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Ben Rimmelauer, actor, playwright, director, and creator of the shows Bad with Money and Patty Issues. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevinah on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim, Chen Denachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The Jewish festivals of Purim and Passover are exactly 1 month apart on the Jewish calendar, both falling at about the time of the full moon. Purim was last week on the 14th of the Jewish calendar month of Adar, while Passover begins on the 15th of the Jewish calendar month of Nisan. Since lunar months vary a bit, that's right around the full moon in the case of both festivals. In general, Jewish holidays fall either on or around the new moon, like Rosh Hashanah or Hanukkah, or at the full moon, like Purim, Passover, and Sukkot, part of our deep connection to the lunar cycle. Which means that now that Purim is in our rearview mirror, we are approaching the remarkable season of Pesach, Passover, a period when we explore the concept of freedom, its extraordinary importance, and its meaning to us personally. For Jews, freedom is intimately tied up with the Exodus, with the need to leave a place of constriction and servitude, of slavery and abuse, in order to achieve freedom and covenant. In the Passover Seder, the first two nights of Pesach are coming up a little less than 4 weeks from now, March 30th and 31st. The main thematic statement is, in every generation, each of us must see ourselves as though we personally came out of Egypt. Perhaps because our birth as a people took place through the process of leaving Egypt, there's something powerful and intrinsic in the Jewish response to immigration. We Jews have a kind of internalized understanding of how the original Exodus and all of our subsequent enforced wandering entered into our souls. Israeli poet Amnon Rybak said it beautifully in his poem, Kol Adam Tzarich Mitzrayim, everybody needs Egypt. Everyone needs his own personal Egypt, to be Moses himself in the midst of it with a strong hand or gritted teeth. Everyone needs terror and great darkness and comfort and security and salvation, to know how to lift his eyes to heaven. Everyone needs one prayer that will always be on his lips. A man needs to surrender once. Everyone needs a shoulder. Everyone needs his own personal Egypt to redeem himself from the house of bondage, to leave at midnight into the wilderness of fears, to stride straight into the midst of the waters, to see them open before him on both sides. Everyone needs a shoulder to lift up the bones of Joseph. Everyone needs to straighten up. Everyone needs his own personal Egypt and Jerusalem, and one long journey to remember forever in his feet. That was Amnon Rybak's poem, Everyone Needs Egypt. You see, immigration is in our blood, in our hearts, and yes, often in our feet as well as Jews. That has made these past couple of years of anti-immigrant rhetoric here in America very strange indeed for us. We have always been the beneficiary of the United States' understanding of itself as a nation of immigrants and of the children and grandchildren of immigrants. America, from its beginnings, has been the gathering place of the tired, the poor, the tempest-tossed, the wretched refuse of the teeming shores of other nations, as Emma Lazarus put it in her poem on the base of the Statue of Liberty. Our love of this country is in no small measure based on America's seemingly infinite capacity to accept the rejected peoples of the world and make of them a new, better, stronger, finer, more creative, innovative, entrepreneurial, and caring nation.
For we come on the ship they call the Mayflower. We come on the ship that sails the moon. We come coming ages most certain out and sing an American tune.
To paraphrase our president, it has been the very immigrants from the crud hole countries of the world who have built this country and kept it strong and successful. And no one should understand that better than we Jews, who have found in America not only a refuge, but a true home. To play us in this morning as part of our pre-Passover preview of music for Pesach, here's Safam's setting of Psalm 114, When Israel Came Out of Egypt.
Hayta Yehuda likadsho, Yisrael mamshilotav. Hayamera hayanos, hayardeini sov leachor. Neharim rakidu v'yelim, givaot kivenei tzor. Malecha hayam Tarus, Hayarden Tishov Leachor, Eharim Tirpedu Chayelim, Gevaot Kivenei Tzon. Milifnei Adon Chuli Aretz, Milifnei Uchayakov, Ahofi Hatsur Akamayim,
the group Safam's setting of the Passover Psalm 114, When Israel Came Forth from Egypt. Our guest this morning, Ben Rimmelauer, is an actor, playwright, director, and creator of the shows Bad with Money and Patty Issues, and, well, he's very Jewish. Maybe too Jewish. Find out how theater has helped him overcome his personal challenges when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Ben Rimmelauer, is the author and star of two very entertaining one-man shows, Bad with Money and Patty Issues, which have now been issued on Audible.com, which he'll explain to us. He's an actor, director, and in a way a comedian. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations. Tell us what, because technology changes so fast, what it means to have something released on Audible.com.
Well, Audible is the modern digital warehouse for what we used to call books on tape. And then they became books on CD, and now they're mostly just files in the cloud that we buy access to, just like music on iTunes.
It's amazing.
As a matter of fact, you can get audiobooks on iTunes as well.
Yeah, that's right. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm not surprised to be on a show called Too Jewish, because that's been the big joke, and most of my friends has always been whether I'm more Jewish or more gay, and that's one of the great existential questions. But certainly been a strong argument for Jewish. I'm born in New York, but we moved to L.A. when I was five, both very, you know, Jewish,
very Jewish
areas to be in. And I grew up in L.A., and I came back to New York after college. And it's funny, seeing you're too Jewish, when I got to college at UC Berkeley in California, coming from L.A., it was surprising to me how few Jews I was being around. You know, I mean, I went to Hillel, and I met Jewish people, but it wasn't like the way I grew up, where, you know, everybody got off of school for Yom Kippur. And I remember people saying to me, like, you're Jewish. Oh, my God, I'm meeting so many Jews, because I'll just, you know, relative to where you're from.
I'm going to go against stereotype here. The idea that Jews are good with money, your play is called Bad with Money.
Exactly.
Tell us more, a little bit about it.
Well, you know, for me, that feels kind of like a Jewish thing, too. I mean, I feel, and I certainly sort of trace in my show, that my grandparents on both sides were the children of immigrants who, you know, came through the Lower East Side and the Bronx.
Probably came through Ellis Island originally. And
they were very committed in the 50s and 60s to moving out to suburbs and driving Cadillacs. And, you know, being these sort of upper middle class Americans was very important to them in terms of their identity, you know. And there was a Jewishness to that. But I think that being upper middle class Americans is their biggest source of pride in a way, you know, because of what their parents and their grandparents had been through. And I, you know, I think they all were kind of bad with money. I mean, they certainly spent beyond their means, and there's stories about both my grandfathers getting into all kinds of trouble in business. And you know, and as a matter of fact, whenever I hear this sort of Jewish stereotype of being stingy, it never made sense to me, because I always thought of my family as being, you know, money drunk. So that was what I thought Jewish was.
We will come back in just a few moments with Ben Rimlauer, hear more about his shows and his experience as a performer. Again, just a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So it's Oscar telecast tonight, and one of the films nominated for Best Picture and Best Actor and a number of other awards is Call Me By Your Name, which is set in Italy and with a Jewish family. And there are people who didn't realize there was strong native Jewish community still in Italy.
Well, it's interesting. It's set in the north of Italy, but it's really about an American family who own a country home in the rural countryside, gorgeous nature.
Don't we all?
Near the lakes in northern Italy.
Of course.
Not clear how they acquired this house. The guy is a professor at an American college. His wife is of mysterious, unidentified origins, but speaks American English. And one of the oddities about this film that remains unexplained, it may be explained in the book, which I haven't read.
By the way, the book that, also by Asiman, the important Jewish North African author.
So everybody in this film is fluent in American English, French, and Italian, which is a mystery. But one of my friends called panic because the young man who was nominated for Best Actor, and he's like the youngest nominee since 1939 or something, Timothée Chalamet, grew up in New York City. It's like an American mother and a French father, or vice versa. I don't know. So he's clearly bilingual and maybe only learned Italian for the movie. I have no idea, but
also Jewish, I should add.
Right. So his name is Elio in the movie. The part he plays is a young man who's like probably late teen high school kid who falls in love with a visiting professor from an American college who's probably 10 or 15 years older than he is. And every summer they have a visiting professor because his father brings colleagues and does archaeology with them, whatever. So the visiting professor wears a Magen David around his neck and they talk about their Jewish identity.
And the visiting professor played by Armie Hammer, who's also of Jewish origin since his grandfather was Armand Hammer. And anyway, let's go on.
All right. I have no idea about the Hammer family, but okay, if you say so, I believe you. So they talk about their Jewish identity. The family describes themselves as discreet Jews, but they do celebrate Hanukkah with latkes and whatever. And by the end of the movie, the young man called Elio is also wearing a Magen David. So a friend of mine called me in a panic saying, I thought all the Jews of Italy were killed in the Holocaust. Well, first of all, they weren't, because the Italians were very reluctant partners. They weren't enthusiastic anti-Semites. They weren't eagerly shipping out their Jews to concentration camps. And even Mussolini, who was a partner of Hitler in the war, was a reluctant and late joiner in the project of the Final Solution. So a fair number of Italian Jews survived. More importantly, in this movie, these people aren't supposed to be Italian Jews. They're American Jews who spend every summer, they go by the academic calendar. The guy is off when college is closed in the summer and for a couple weeks at Christmas time. So the family occupies this gorgeous villa periodically. For whatever reason, they all speak Italian, but they are not Italian Jews. The question of who is an Italian Jew is a very interesting question, which we will visit in greater depth next week, I guess.
Thanks, Tom. Talk to you then.
Look forward to it.
As part of our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music, here's the Siman LeSeder Shel Pesach, the table of contents of the Haggadah, the order for the meal of freedom, as sung to a Sephardic melody.
Magid racha moti macha maror korech shulchan orech tafun barech ale nirecha.
That was Kadesh Ur Chatz for the great festival of Passover coming up in a little less than a month. We welcome our Shin Shinim, Hendinachi and Tamir Shakuri, who have returned from a trip home to Israel not too long ago. Brief trip, less than 2 weeks. Tell us about the experience of, you know, there's an old American novel by Thomas Wolfe that says, you can't go home again. You went home again. What does it feel like? How is it different?
Hi.
Shalom, shalom.
So going home, well, first of all, it was short. It felt like 2 seconds. And on the other hand, coming back felt like we haven't been here in like 2 years. And I don't know, it's weird. A vacation at home is a very weird feeling because it's like, on one hand, you're back home. On the other hand, you're not here for long. And it's like, I don't know, it's just, it feels weird, but it was so good. Like seeing everyone, seeing my family, seeing my friends.
Seeing your dog.
Seeing my dog, Mitzi. Mitzi, I love you for hearing this. And it just, it's a really cool feeling coming back and seeing how everything that you talked about with the people in America is actually like, how is it driving in Israel? And people keep telling you Israelis are rude and you forget until you go back and you, wow, people in Israel are rude. So yeah, I mean, it broke a few stigmas.
It is funny how our perceptions change in a short period of time. Tamir, what was the most surprising thing for you going back?
I think the most surprising thing was how much have not changed. So
how much is the same?
Yeah. So I came back to Israel and I was expecting the whole world to change under my feet. And I came back and everything was the same. My friends are doing different things, but when we all sat together, essentially we were the same people talking about the same stuff, laughing the same way. It made me feel good about what I'm doing here because I feel like here I live in a different world and doing amazing things. And then when I come back, then everything stays the same. So I don't feel like I'm really missing anything worthwhile to stay there and not be here doing what I really like to do. So, yeah.
What were your favorite things that you did when you went back to Israel?
So, probably spending time with my friends, going to eat in all of my favorite spots in Tel Aviv.
You guys are both foodies, so that's not a surprise.
But yeah, I mean, seeing the beach, which is the one thing I can say Tucson doesn't have.
No, really doesn't.
And just kind of hanging out with my family, seeing my parents. Like, my mom, I talk to quite a lot on the phone, but my dad, you know, like, he's not very technological, so talking to my brother was great. Just kind of spending time with everyone was my favorite part, and eating definitely.
And because you never eat here in America, of course. we will talk next week. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe has a fight with Sadie, his wife, and goes to the movies to cool off. After the film is done, he decides to call home just to see what the situation is and maybe even apologize. "Hi, honey," he says. "So what are you making for dinner?" "What am I making, you jerk?" his wife answers. "Poison. That's what I'm making, poison." And Moshe replies, "So make just one portion. I'm not coming home for dinner." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Hope is a tangible, unstated presence in our portion this week, Vayakel Pekudei, the double portion at the end of the book of Exodus. On the surface, this Seder, this Parsha, is nothing more than a listing of how the tabernacle in the wilderness was constructed by our ancestors, lists of materials used, processes employed, structures and implements assembled. So many pieces of wood or gold or skins of animals are used to make this item. These artisans were employed on that project. Moses asked for these materials and they were graciously donated, and so on and so forth. But in another sense, this is an incredibly hopeful Torah portion, a section that truly represents the triumph of hope over experience. For in last week's Torah portion of Ki Tisa, the people of Israel dramatically failed both God and Moses. They made a golden calf and worshipped it and bowed before it and insisted that it was their God. Just 40 days after receiving the Ten Commandments at Sinai, they forgot the revelation and abandoned monotheism and morality and everything they had just been taught, including the second commandment prohibiting the worship of idols. It was a devastating moment for Moses. It must have been a fundamentally depressing time for God, too. Yet just a few passages later, we find God instructing Moses to build a tabernacle, a permanent home for the Shekhinah, the divine presence, right in the midst of this same rotten people. Those people, the Israelites, our ancestors, have just proven they are not worthy, and yet God immediately gives them a place. No, insists that they create a space that will be a constant, permanent reminder that God will always be with them and never abandon them. It seems almost like a reward for treachery, but actually, it's a promise of hope. For if God will dwell among them, Asuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham, we were told in the earlier Torah portion of Truma, build me a sanctuary and I will dwell among you. It's a pledge that things can always be made good, that losses can be, in some sense, replaced, that we are always able to come into grace and blessing. The juxtapositioning of this portion is important. Its placement between the betrayal of the golden calf and the blessings of the brand spanking new tabernacle, model for every temple in Jewish history, is a promise and pledge of hope. You may know the Hebrew word for hope, tikvah, from the national anthem of Israel, HaTikvah. But for me, tikvah is a promise from God that even after our worst moments, even in our depths of despair or failure, we can return to holiness and goodness. And God will be present for us and among us. So may it always be. When we return here on To Jewish, our guest, Ben Rimmelauer, actor, playwright, director, and creator of the shows Bad with Money and Patty Issues, will explain just how Jewish his theatrical work is, and much more, All that when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem will open in May 2018 to coincide with the 70th anniversary of Israel's independence, two Trump administration officials said last week. Congress was notified of the impending move after Secretary of State Rex Tillerson signed off on the security plan for the new embassy. State Department confirmed the timing of the move. An official said, "We are planning to open the new U.S. embassy in Israel in Jerusalem in May. The embassy's opening will coincide with Israel's 70th anniversary. The embassy will initially be located in Arnona, that's in South Jerusalem, on a compound that currently houses the consular operations of Consulate General Jerusalem. Initially, it will consist of the ambassador and a small team. A ribbon-cutting ceremony is being planned for mid-May. Israel proclaimed independence May 14, 1948 on the Western calendar, although Israel celebrates its anniversary of independence according to the Hebrew calendar. Yom HaAtzmaut, Independence Day, falls on April 19th this year. The May opening marks a significant acceleration. Vice President Mike Pence had said previously the embassy would open by the end of 2019. Tillerson had said it could take years. The date of the move is seen as largely symbolic. The logistics of a permanent relocation will take longer. Most of the embassy staff will continue to operate from Tel Aviv during the early stages. Staff at the Jerusalem consulate were told last week that as of mid-May, they will be considered employees of the embassy. In its initial phase, Ambassador David Friedman will move to the consular premises. The building will be formally redesignated as the U.S. Embassy. Eventually, an entirely new purpose-built building will be constructed to house the American Embassy in Jerusalem. In other news, harassment, threats, and vandalism targeting Jews in the United States surged to near record levels in 2017. They jumped 57% over the previous year, according to a new report by the Anti-Defamation League. The ADL counted 1,986 anti-Semitic incidents, second highest number since the group began tracking them nearly four decades ago, reversing a downward trend over the recent decades. The figure represents the largest annual jump the ADL has ever recorded. Physical attack, which accounted for fewer than 1% of the incidents, was the only category that fell, although, of course, it is the most dangerous of all anti-Semitic events. The overall count, based on data from law enforcement, victims, and local Jewish organizations, includes an increase in bomb threats against Jewish centers, vandalism at synagogues and Jewish cemeteries, and threats at schools. "We've never had a moment like this," said Jonathan Greenblatt, chief executive of the New York-based ADL. "We've seen so much intolerance sneak into the public." Greenblatt pointed to newly resurgent white supremacists, such as those who took part in the deadly Charlottesville, Virginia rally last year, as a major factor in the rise. "Hate groups and white supremacists feel emboldened, and they are not just coming out online, but also getting involved in political campaigns," Greenblatt said. He also cited the divisive state of our national discourse and a poor example set by President Trump, who at times has been very slow to denounce anti-Semitic attacks, and during his presidential campaign retweeted white supremacists and used what Greenblatt described as anti-Semitic imagery in social media posts. Trump has denied any ill feeling towards Jews, noting that he has Jewish grandchildren, calling himself the least anti-Semitic person you've ever seen in your entire life. The ADL audit counted 1,015 incidents of harassment, a jump of over 41% since 2016. They included 163 bomb threats against Jewish centers. Law enforcement arrested two men in Missouri and Israel, as reported here on Too Jewish last year, on separate charges of making those threats. The audit also tallied 952 incidences of vandalism, an increase of 86%. The number of physical assaults fell from 36 to 19, a decline of nearly 50%. "Anti-Semitism is the canary in the coal mine," Greenblatt said. "It often augurs other forms of bias, xenophobia, misogyny, and racism." Other civil rights groups have raised concerns recently about rising intolerance in the U.S. In the annual count of hate groups released this month, the Southern Poverty Law Center found that the number of white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups has grown the most last year, from 99 to 121. The FBI's latest data on hate crimes, released in November, showed 6,121 took place in 2016, about a 5% increase compared to 2015. More than half were deemed to be racially motivated. Growing reports of anti-Semitic incidents led the ADL last year to increase its data collection effort. It's possible that the unprecedented numbers this year are in part the result of more people reporting crimes and threats. After the Charlottesville Unite the Right demonstration, which featured Nazi chants, President Trump was harshly criticized for refusing to budge on his view that the rally included some very fine people. Trump also drew criticism last year for deliberately leaving out the mention of Jews in a statement on Holocaust Remembrance Day. He mentioned them this year. In another instance, Jonathan Greenblatt lashed out at the president for waiting 6 weeks before denouncing bomb threats against U.S. Jewish community centers. The growing anti-Semitism in the U.S. comes amid a decline worldwide. In April, a report from the Cantor Center for the Study of Contemporary European Jewry at Tel Aviv University found that anti-Semitism incidents dropped 12% globally. But the center, which surveyed 40 countries, said several English-speaking nations bucked the trend, including Britain, Australia, and the U.S. By the ADL's count, the worst year for anti-Semitism in the U.S. was 1994. The group recorded 2,066 incidents back then. That was the year a number of deadly clashes took place between Israelis and Palestinians. It was also the time when the peace treaty was signed between Israel and Jordan. And finally, Malcolm Hohenlein, executive vice president of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations for 3 decades and a past guest of Two Jewish, is stepping down after more than 30 years in charge of the umbrella foreign policy group for the U.S. Jewish community. Current conference chairman Steven Greenberg said Hohenlein, who has been the group's top professional since 1986, timed his retirement to coincide with the search for a new chairman. While Malcolm continues to be a uniquely vital and energetic leader and an irreplaceable asset, he felt the transition process should be put in place. He will continue to serve the conference as he has so effectively for more than 3 decades as we seek an executive to assume responsibility for the conference's ongoing operations and activities. He will then focus on external relations as well as plans to structure the conference for the years ahead. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Ben Rimmelauer, is the author and star of two off Broadway, long running, critically acclaimed shows, Bad with Money and Patty Issues. Patty Issues about his involvement, obsession with Patty LuPone, and then actually, we'll have him tell the story. Both of which continue to be performed. Both are now available on audible.com, just recently released. Ben, tell us. Now, is it, again, I'm going to stereotypes, is it true that all gay guys who love theater also love Patti LuPone?
No, she's a polarizing figure. I mean, that's like saying all New York Jews who like baseball love the Yankees. I mean, they're a Mets fan, you know? It's Patti LuPone and Bernadette Peters, I would say, competing for that crown.
Both great musical performers, of course, we have to say, you know. Tell us your Patti issues, if you would.
Yes, well, like many people in my generation, influential TV commercial in my early childhood, the late 70s, early 80s, was the commercial for Evita with Patti LuPone. You know, sort of the precursor to the Les Mis and Phantom and the sort of big 80s musicals.
Yeah, those ads with Don't Cry For Me, Argentina that you used to see all the time, right?
Exactly. You know, I mean, it was very commercials in the Smithsonian because it was a great TV commercial. And I was so mesmerized by her in that commercial. And I lived in New York when I was little, and I got to see a couple of shows like you'd expect, Peter Pan and whatever, Fiddler on the Roof, of course. You know, but I was scared in Fiddler on the Roof. I mean, we would listen to the record, and we'd get to Frumacera's part. My grandparents would change. This is very dating myself now. My grandparents would change the record speed, so it sounded like the Chipmunks. I didn't get scared, you know. And if Evita is a dark story about a fascist and, you know, the sexual themes, and they weren't taking this 4 or 5 year old kid to see Evita. But that just added to the mystique for me. And then when I was a teenager in LA and getting really into musical theater, into Phantom and Les Mis, sort of found my way back to Evita and was just obsessed. And of course, I mean, I still love that show, but what really drew me was the power of Patti LuPone's performance, and it's really felt on that cast album where she was just doing sort of monstrous things with her voice, and I have never looked back from that.
So you created this show. Had you met Patti LuPone at that point?
I had. Well, I began my career actually as a director. I only sort of morphed into writing and performing more in the last 5 or 6 years. But I started my career as a director in New York by assistant directing, and a couple of the first shows I worked on were with Patti LuPone, including Sweeney Todd at the New York Philharmonic. And so, of course, that was a dream come true for me.
Sure.
And me being this, you know, 23-year-old gay kid that was obsessed with her, I was right up Patti's alley. So we got along great, you know. And so we've been friends for a long time. And there actually ended up being a couple of bumps in the road in that relationship. But that's part of what I explore in Patti Issues. I mean, the reason it's called Patti Issues is because it's a play on the word daddy issues. It's kind of about my story with Patti juxtaposed with my estranged relationship with my father, who's a piece of work, and he's also gay. So, you know, you'd think there'd be a lot in common between us, but there's just a lot of drama. And basically what I sort of look for in Patti Issues is ways that coming to terms with the problems I had with Patti LuPone and my obsession with her and kind of getting to know her as a real person and accepting her as a human being, not a, you know, childhood hero, and being okay with that as a separate adult in the universe sort of helped me to find my own footing as far as, you know, thinking about my father.
It's a really fascinating, complicated tale. Your dad came out, obviously, I assume it was something of a shock to your mom and your family. Tell us a little bit about that experience, if it's not too much.
You know, my poor father, I mean, he's been through a lot. He is a child of these, you know, second-generation American Jews who strived very hard to live up to this sort of I Love Lucy and, you know, Dick Van Dyke America that they were proud to be a part of. And right. He was an only child, and when he was not the right kind of boy when he was little, playing with dolls and stuff, you know, they put a lot of pressure on him. And he tried to tell them he was gay when he was in college, and, you know, they sort of shamed him out of it and sent him to a therapist that was going to fix him. And he didn't really have a role model to imagine a different kind of life, and it really did a number on him. And then when he married my mother, they were both very young, and they immediately started having children. And it was just too much for him. He was really a gay man, and he started rebelling against that, and he was cheating on my mom. And then it was the 80s, and it was L.A. Excuse me. And I think that he saw this other life that he could live of all these gay men who were out of the closet and, you know, happy and proud. And he wanted that, but I think he had so much resentment against his parents and resentment against my mother and resentment against himself. And, you know, he didn't know where to channel all that. He got into trouble with drugs, and it was a very dark time. I think that so much of him expressing who he was came out through anger. It was hard for him to have a fresh start in a good way with me and my sister.
Do you still struggle with that?
With my father?
Yeah.
Well, we don't talk. I mean, I was, and which is part of the talk about the show, how I was eventually adopted by my stepfather. My father was sort of such a source of trauma. I mean, really, you know, nothing physical, but kind of a child abuse, the way he emotionally dumped on me and my sister for years. It was certainly a very defining thing in my life. I think that now in my 40s, years of therapy, I think I've made peace with it. And I think that's kind of what I explore in the show, is how my journey with Patti LuPone oddly gave me some perspective on my father, but I don't have a relationship with him.
So the next show has to be about some other great trauma in your life?
Well, Bad with Money is certainly about a trauma. I mean, the difference with Bad with Money is that, you know, in Patti Issues, it's a charming story. This horrible, scary, upsetting thing happens to this little kid, and I'm the little kid, and I'm just like, cute, I like musicals. And the audience is like, aw, and then it's a happy ending. Right. And but in Bad with Money, I'm this, you know, piece of shit that's like defrauding business associates and prostituting and doing drugs, and it's just a very different thing than the other show.
Yeah, you've been through so many things. To turn that into art, is it difficult? Is it challenging to go back through all of that, or is it cathartic, or both?
Both. I mean, it's. I think with Patty Issues, it felt like a relief. You know, I think after so many years being a director behind the scenes, finally telling my story as a writer and performing it myself as an actor, felt like something I needed to do. You know, and I felt. So joyful in doing it, and it felt like you know, it really wasn't difficult in that sense. I mean, it was difficult, you know, to work with my director and get it right, but and Bad With Money was harder because it felt scarier to be honest about things that didn't reflect well on character, and it was scary to try to tell these things as a theatrical piece of entertainment because they don't have a clean beginning, middle, and end like other stories I've told do, you know, and that was sort of the controversial thing about this show, Bad With Money, is that half of the people that saw it said, this isn't art, you know, this is like therapy, there's no end to this, you know, and then the other half of people said, this is brilliant, this is so brave, this is what art needs to do, there's not like a trite thing at the end of everything's fine now. It's about real life problems that we struggle with on a day-to-day basis and bravely looking at this thing that nobody wants to talk about, which is money, and it's plaguing our country. And, you know, I mean, it was really a divided response. I mean, I you know, Patty Issues had nothing like that kind of polarization.
What's the most moving response you've had to Bad With Money?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, there was an actor that I knew, I guess I shouldn't say his name, but he came to the show and I didn't see him afterwards. And I thought that was odd because I knew he was going to be there. So I thought, oh, maybe he didn't like it or, you know, I mean, I'd seen him at the beginning, you know, but, you know, whatever. But then when I got home later that night, there was a long email from him saying that I reminded him so much of his brother. And he was so moved. And he wrote this long poem about me and his brother and our struggles with money. And it was like, it was staggering. I mean, it was really unlike anything I've ever seen. It was really beautiful. But, you know, I mean, honestly, the truth is the shows are so personal that really, I've had really moving responses from people with both shows. I mean, I think, you know, I aside even from the quality of the piece of work that I've created, I think that I've really just done something that's honest and personal, and I think that the people around the world have really responded to that because, you know, as we get more and more into our technology and everything, I think that a live experience of somebody, you know, just going through something together eye to eye is a really welcome experience for people.
So what's your next piece going to be?
Well, you know, it sort of branched out. I mean, I had put off directing stuff for a couple of years while I was working on those two shows. So now I'm sort of catching up on that stuff and doing some weird things. And then the shows led to more writing and acting things for me that I'm working on, but they're not necessarily solo plays, you know. I mean, I'm writing a children's musical based on the book Who Needs Donuts. And, you know, I'm acting in this play about Elaine Stritch, where I play this gay guy obsessed with her. So it's kind of similar to...
Gosh, that sounds so familiar.
But I didn't write it, you know.
Right.
I mean, and it's not me. I mean, it's so me, but it's not me. So I don't know. I'm working on a memoir, which will combine elements of both of those plays, Patty Issues and Bad With Money, but it's, you know, it's a different concept. I mean, those were really written in my voice talking live to an audience, and I'm still figuring out what my voice as a memoirist is. I do think I have another solo play like that in me, but I haven't really sat down to it yet.
All right, so I'm going to ask a rabbi question. How are you doing with money?
Well, not well. I mean, you know, that's the short answer. I find that it's kind of a, I don't know, I'd like to say 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. That's maybe the best possible explanation of it, you know, perspective on it. I think sometimes it feels more like it's 2 and 2 or even the other way around. It's, You know, I mean, I talk in Bad with Money about how I got sober from drugs and alcohol. That was relatively easy for me. I mean, I've been sober for 7 years. I quit smoking cigarettes 8 years ago.
And hey, mazel tov, those matter. That's incredible.
Thank you. Thank you. But, you know, I don't think those were my drug of choice. You know, I went to rehab and I went to meetings and I'm humbled about it. I don't want to say it's easy for me, but I somehow was able to just sort of turn the page on that, you know, in this way that's say all or nothing, black and white. Money is this thing, like people's addictions with food, I think, are similar, even sex, where, you know, you kind of need to find balance, and moderation is what I've struggled with most. And so it's like, you know, they talk about in 12-step programs, my disease, the alcohol disease, or, you know, the spending money disease is cunning and just powerful. And that really rings true for me. I mean, I feel like, you know, if I focus on, okay, I've got to stop eating out so much. I've got to save money by going to the grocery store and cooking. And I do that, I'll be amazed how over time I will have developed some new thing that insidiously became a habit I didn't think of that was a different way to spend too much money, you know?
Right.
And you know, and now it's all these decades in. I mean, I've been on this journey, you know, I mean, I left my parents' house when I was 18, and it's just kind of one disaster after another. I don't know. I don't really have a happy answer to that. But I'm trying to be mindful and do everything I can do. And, you know, I'm certainly trying to be as honest as possible.
I want to thank Ben Rimmelauer for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Wish him luck with that continued struggle. You can hear his very entertaining plays, Patty Issues and Bad with Money, and tell people where to go to get them.
You can get them on Audible. You can get them on iTunes, and you can get them on Amazon. Maybe the easiest thing for people to spell is Bad with Money or Patty Issues, if they remember it's within an I. That's Patty. Well, so is Issues. Of course, you can just Google. I mean, truthfully, if you Google, like, gay guy, Patty LuPone, one-man show. I mean, surprisingly, I'm the only thing that comes up, so you can't miss it.
Ben, thanks so much, and good luck with all of it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Ike Shapiro, author of the new book, Edoko, Growing Up a Stateless Foreigner in Wartime Japan. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning is another from our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music, the Maccabees' mashup of various ways to sing Dayenu, the classic Seder song. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Ilu, ilu, hotzianu, hotzianu, mimitraim, hotzianu, mimitraim, dayenu, day, dayenu, day, dayenu, day, dayenu, 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 day, dayenu, day, dayenu, Dai dayenu, dayenu, dayenu. Dum
da dum. Eilu ilu koralanu, koralanu etayam, koralanu etayam.
Dayenu, dai dayenu, dai dayenu,
dai
dayenu, dayenu, dayenu. Dai dayenu, dai.
Natalanu, Natalanu, et shabareta shaba natan lanu dayenu dai dayenu dai dayenu dai dayenu dayenu dai dayenu dai dayenu dai dayenu dayenu
ilu ilu kebanu lese hasi da lese hasi da dayenu.
Aviva, it's time to open the door for Eliyahu.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.